Hello, and welcome to the 404 Media Podcast, where we bring you unparalleled access to hidden worlds, both online and IRL. 404 Media is a journalist-founded company and needs your support. To subscribe, go to 404media.co. As well as bonus content every single week, subscribers can also get access to additional episodes where we respond to their best comments. Gain access to that content at 404media.co. I'm your host, Joseph, and with me are 404 Media co-founders Sam Cole.
Hi.
Emmanuel Mayberg.
Hello.
And Jason Kebler.
Hello, hello.
All right, let's get right into it. This one is pretty technical, not going to lie, but the ramifications are massive. It's a really, really important story that maybe listeners already saw a bit about over the weekend, but the XE backdoor highlights the vulnerability of open source software and its strengths. Basically, a backdoor has been placed, or attempted to be placed, I should say, in a piece of software that's widely used by Linux. Before we get into the technical details, how was this backdoor discovered, Jason, and how did everyone learn about it? Because I feel like you watched it unfold in sort of near real time with everybody else.
Yeah, I think I kind of woke up Saturday morning and saw it all over every timeline that I have, like every social media timeline. So I saw it most of all on Mastodon, which is more of a software developer world, I would say. But this was discovered on Friday by a software developer at Microsoft named Andreas Freund. Freund, I believe, mispronounced word of the week.
There's gonna be lots of those. I already know from some stuff that I'm gonna have to say, so apologies in advance. But they find it. How do they do that?
Yeah. So as I understand it, they were running this utility called XZ Utils, which is the Linux utility that has the backdoor in it. I want to preface this whole thing with I'm not a software developer. I'm definitely not an open source software developer, and I'm not a security researcher. So I'm going to do my best to get the technical aspects of this correct. There may be some problems here, but I think the broader point of sort of what it says about software development and our reliance on open source software is the point of doing this specific article. There was a really good technical write-up by Ars Technica about what this is. But let me just like start with that, because I don't even know if you would call XZ backdoor a piece of software. Like, I don't think that it is actually software. I think it's a utility.
Sure.
So, I mean, let's start even there. It's just like it's an underlying component of parts of Linux, and it's open source. It rolls into a lot of the different Linux distributions, like this exists in Red Hat, and it exists in a few other ones.
Fedora, Debian, yeah. I believe as well. Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is very standard. That's very normal, right? Where you have different flavors or forks of Linux, they often share the same underlying components because they are basically, well, not reskins, that's too little, but they're variations on the same thing, which if you get a backdoor in something which stretches across all of them, that's pretty powerful.
It's really bad. And it's also like, I think that thinking about why things like this matter, which I know we haven't explained the thing yet, but it's like you hear a Linux virus or Linux backdoor or Linux hack, and you're like, okay, well, I'm not a Linux nerd. Like, who cares? But it's like Linux runs a lot of internet infrastructure, like a lot of internet infrastructure that you interact with, even if you're on a Mac, even if you're on a PC. And that's why it is bad. You know, it would be bad if it only affected people who are running Linux on their laptops or whatever. But for the most part, it's like when there's something at such a low level like this, like in, you know, a utility that's used in a lot of different Linux distributions, it's like we can be talking like millions or billions of devices depending on what it is and how widely used it is. So all that said, this guy, Andreas Freund, is running something on his computer, and he realizes that it's running too hot, essentially. And he's like, it was like too loud. And he goes and he starts inspecting it, and he's like, oh, you know, something is wrong with XZ Utils. And he basically like dives into it and realizes that someone had put a backdoor into XZutils that connected to SSH encryption, which is a type a security protocol, an encryption protocol that encrypts communications with unsecured servers. Yeah, SSH encryption, like, wildly important, but
yeah, people use it every single day. You use that to connect to a server. So let's say I'm using my computer in my home. I want to connect to a remote server that I have in a data center owned by DigitalOcean or whatever. Like, it doesn't really matter. It's a remote computer, right? And that that gap between your home machine and this remote machine, like, who knows what's going on between there? So you want to connect to it securely, and you do that with SSH, basically. Yeah, every single day people are doing this,
right? And so he discovers essentially a backdoor in the code to XZutils, and this wasn't like a hack, this was purposefully put there by a trusted maintainer of XZutils, meaning that one of the developers who makes XZutils put it in. Like, that's nominally what it means. It's like the person who made this commit, which is like updating the code in XZutils, put this backdoor in place, and it had been there for at least a month.
Yeah.
And so Andres, the guy who discovered this, goes to this listserv called OSS Security, which is open source software security. It's a big listserv of open source developers and software security experts, where they talk about nerd things, to be honest. And he sends this email called backdoor and upstream XZ/libzema leading to SSH server compromise. And it is like a, you know, 2000 word email with a bunch of code in it. And essentially, he's like, hey, I think this is bad. And essentially, like, I don't know, this email thread is now a couple hundred emails long, and people are like really realizing that the potential implications of something like this. And the reason that it's a big deal is because this was not like a hack as we think about it. It is, as I said, someone who was trusted to maintain this software put this in, and there was sort of no oversight of the commit that they made, the code update that they made, and it could have been distributed like extremely widely. I think in this case, people got very lucky because it was not integrated into these very important, like your Fedoras and your Red Hat, etc., because there's usually a lag between an update of a utility like that and it being included in a really big Linux release, essentially.
Jason, could you say a word about just the open source software ecosystem where people who might not necessarily get paid or work for any particular company, though sometimes they do, are maintaining these hugely important open source software tools that the entire internet uses? Even if you're not like using it directly, you are using software that is like built on top of it.
Yeah, that was the point of the article. And I think the ultimate point that I wanted to make is that open source software is software that is developed collaboratively. Open source means anyone can go see the source, but it often means that anyone can edit the source or, you know, propose changes or design features or so on and so forth. And because this is like a big community run like project, it's like it's often more secure because you have a bunch of people being able to audit the code. But then you also have, you know, a lot of people contributing to it. And it's in many ways, it's kind of like Wikipedia in that it's like this big collective project that everyone's like going back and forth and everyone's checking each other and so on and so forth. And with open source software in particular, a lot of the stuff happens on GitHub, and people will design a piece of software and then that software will be integrated into a larger commercial product very often. And so it's like huge parts of Google, huge parts of Facebook, huge parts of Microsoft, huge parts of like almost any software company you can imagine are taking these open source projects and they are integrating them into their paid or otherwise monetized like products that they're making tons and tons of money off of.
I mean, there's a really big example of that where there's a developer who made the tool called Curl, C-U-R-L, and it's basically a tool for doing web requests in a way. So you curl something, it's like you were telling your computer, go get that resource and bring it back to me. And you can use it in a variety of ways. And it's like a technical underpinning of basically countless tools across the internet. And he will sometimes get, the developer will sometimes get emails being like, hey, we need you to fix this. Like as if he's like providing a product or something. It's like, why are you emailing me? Like I'm doing this out of the kindness of my heart, basically. And you have the audacity to come and like yell at me about it. And he often screenshots these and tweets them. And it's really good fun. But you mentioned that it's usually a collaborative environment, but there's also the flip side of that. It could also be really isolating, right?
Yeah. So, I mean, there's millions of open source products and projects across everything. And it's like some of them have thousands of contributors and they have like funding from Google or Mozilla or like some big foundation. And these are like very important high profile projects. Then you have something like xzutils, which is really, really important. Like it's a fundamental part of Linux that ladders up into, you know, all these Linux distributions, but there's like two people working on it more or less. And it's largely governed. Not all open source projects are governed like this, but many, many open source projects are governed by listserv. So it's just like people on email going back and forth like, hey, add this. Hey, this is broken. Hey, fix this, blah, blah, blah. And what was really, really, really interesting here and like kind of scary is that the person who put this backdoor into xzutils is named Jia Tan, and they have been a trusted maintainer of this project for about 2.5 years. And if you go to the listserv for this project, you know, it's very esoteric. It's very small. Like, again, this is a compression utility, like a file compression utility on Linux. It's like not a sexy thing. But if you go to the listserv, it's like, there are many emails where there are people kind of like making these really big demands of the person who founded and was originally maintaining xzutils and saying like, you're abandoning this project. You're not you're not like giving updates fast enough. You're not doing bug fixes fast enough, so on and so forth, blah, blah, blah. And I don't have their name in front of me right now, but the person who founded this is like, well, I'm very busy. I'm doing this on a volunteer basis. This is very hard. And essentially, there was like a group of people who were like, well, you know who would be a good maintainer of this project would be Jia Tan. Like, right. Jia Tan would be great. And it's really unclear right now whether this was like a concerted effort to install Jia Tan as a maintainer of this project, like if it was a long con essentially to get them to a place where they would have the authority to make these updates without oversight. But that's kind of what it seems like happened here.
Yeah, there are still a ton of questions which don't yet have answers about, you know, ultimately who was responsible beyond that sort of front or moniker or whatever you want to call it, like, you know, potentially what entity or agency was involved here. We don't know that yet. And with that caveat in mind, and that there's still all these answers we don't yet know, I would still give a shout out to a Twitter thread from The Gruck, who is a longtime operational security expert and also analyzes sort of intelligence agency operations. And I won't read the whole thing because it's very long. You should go check it out. But they frame it in the context of like a human intelligence operation. So they say like the XZ backdoor was the final part of a campaign that spanned 2 years of operations. As you say, Jason, they were a maintainer or building up for a couple of years. these operations were predominantly human-style agent operations. There was an approach that lasted months before the Jiatan persona was well-positioned to be given a trusted role. And the thread continues from there, and it basically puts in the context of, as you say, Jason, well, this person's getting really burnt out with maintaining this software. Tan has been there sort of positioning themselves or being positioned as somebody who could take over. And then lo and behold, when the original maintainer burns out, essentially, who is there to take over but this other persona who's been placed there the entire time? Again, look, we don't know exactly, but I think that at minimum is a very interesting way to look at it, you know?
Right. So over the last few years, there's been a lot of kind of like high profile supply chain attacks, which is what this would be called, where someone essentially is able to push a malicious update to a piece of software. And then, you know, that way you don't have to hack one computer. You can hack one like distribution of a piece of software, and then people willingly and unknowingly download this compromised, you know, piece of software. And a really important one was a few years ago, this this like Windows system optimization tool called CC Cleaner was hacked. And it's like the software company itself was hacked, and someone was able to push a signed update to CC Cleaner. So essentially like an official update from the company that had a backdoor in it. And because of what CC Cleaner was, it had like all of this authority within people's computers to do important things. I don't know if it had like root access, but it was able to do, I don't know, Joseph, if you
it was the first part of, I believe, an operation that's been attributed to Chinese intelligence. It was the first stage in like identifying targets, because it's such a popular piece of software, it could then be infected, spread out, and then once it landed on machines that were of interest, the next stage of the payload or the malware could be downloaded. And I don't think that's open source, right?
Right. So what I was going to say is that so 2.2 million people downloaded the infected version of CC Cleaner. And if I remember correctly, the way that worked is someone had to hack someone who worked for the company that made CC Cleaner, or had to like sort of infiltrate the way that their installers worked and their software updates worked, and like pushed it from that company. But in that case, like the company was hacked. In this case, there was like a social engineering slash like charm offensive over the course of years.
Slash gaslight.
Slash gaslighting, where just someone like a persona was able to become this trusted person with a piece of open source software. And I think that's what's really interesting about this to me, is that it kind of exposes all of these vulnerabilities within the open source software ecosystem that are different for every project, but are pretty similar across pieces of software, where it's like you have very often like overworked developers who are doing this in their free time, who, and then you also have like this really demanding group of users who want updates to happen. And then you have this like listserv governance, where I don't know, you don't really know who's on the other side of the screen. And there's often like bullying and gaslighting and like, well, why aren't you taking my idea seriously? Like, let me be in charge vibes. And this took advantage of all of those kind of vulnerabilities. And then, you know, they were able to ultimately do this. And then the last thing I'll say is that it also highlights a lot of the strengths of open source software, because we would never be able to do kind of like a debrief like it is occurring now if this wasn't open source. It's like people were able to see exactly what the code was. People were able to see exactly when it was pushed. People are able to go back through the listserv and see like, well, they said this on this date, and you know, here's what happened.
If it was closed, this would be an email thread going on inside Mandiant or CrowdStrike or something. Like, we wouldn't be able to read it, but now everybody can, and everybody's pouring over it. Exactly.
Right. That reminds me that, speaking of supply chain attacks, another story that we actually published on Motherboard was a Kim Zetter scoop. It was Asus that was pushing out a software update that had a backdoor in it. But in that case, also, it wasn't social engineering scheme, they somehow managed to hack the update system and planted the back door there in the updates that went out. But the way we found out about that one, I think it was Kaspersky detected it. So it's not as if ASUS came out there and was like, oopsie, we found out about this. This is bad. You need to update your machines, blah, blah, blah. Like a third party that works in the space had to call them out.
Right. If we're doing our favorite supply chain attacks, I've got another one. I mean, this is a little bit different, but I find it pretty funny and also scary. Scary because supply chain attacks are very broad in nature because they're indiscriminate by their very definition, right? You're targeting all users potentially of a piece of software. But when you're installing packages, especially for Python, you will do, I don't know, pip install requests, and that downloads like a bundle of code for you to then make writing Python code easier. And what some people do is they will typo squat slight variations of that word. So this is just an example, but instead of requests, let's say it's request, but you maybe hit the A on the keyboard instead of the S or something, and then that will have malware in it. And it's just shitty ethically and sort of technically, but I'm just really glad we talk more about supply chain attacks because they are fascinating and scary and powerful, and I think there's sort of no telling how bad this could have been if it wasn't caught in the way it was.
Yeah. Would the Spencer's vibrator hack that didn't actually happen, would that be a supply chain attack?
Which one is that? I can't remember that.
I think so, yeah. Because the
vibrator. The
thing where they were going to put malware in the vibrator, and we were like, did it happen in the factory?
Oh, yes. Yeah.
You don't remember this, Joe?
There's so much sex toy hacking that kind of...
This was like 3 weeks ago,
Joseph.
It didn't actually happen, though. Okay.
Yeah. We went to Spencer's. Jason and I went to Spencer's, and yeah.
Now I remember.
We tried to give ourselves malware through a vibrator, yeah.
Yes. When you went and you bought it. I think that's supply chain. Yeah, I think that's supply chain. But I mean, literally, you're getting into the physical supply chain of a product at that point.
Yeah.
All right. Let's leave that there. When we come back, we're going to talk about how ChatGPT/AI is not just threatening the writing of academic papers, but also, you know, potentially the entire peer review process. We'll be right back after this. All right, and we are back. Here is one that Emmanuel just published. ChatGPT looms over the peer review crisis. So, yes, as mentioned, we've seen ChatGPT used for writing books, academic papers, and more. We've done that a ton. You've done it, Emmanuel, and Sam's done it as well. What is happening with this story, or what is potentially happening with this story?
So the reason I started to look into this is a researcher reached out to us and said that they got their peer review on a paper they submitted in the humanities. This person wrote a paper about the early spread of gay terminology. And basically they say they got the peer reviews, which are like written responses to your paper that are telling you what the weaknesses are, where you can improve, and so on. And they say that immediately they thought that it was generated by AI. And they say that this is because both the style and the content of the responses just felt that way. And they said it was very generalized responses, didn't really engage with the work. I think probably most listeners at this point have read ChatGPT or used ChatGPT. And there's sort of like a generalized style to the responses you get from these chatbots.
Like a vibe, really.
It's a vibe, but it's also like, you know, in his case, the responses he got, like the critique he got, was very generalized in the sense that it's like, oh, work on your citations or work on your transition, and not really like academically, intellectually engaging with the arguments that he was making in the paper. That was his claim. And he reached out to this journal and said this, and I should back up and say that peer review is usually anonymous. You don't know who is responding to your paper. It's anonymous editors. And he asked if he could connect with them and potentially if the journal would de-anonymize them because he felt so insulted and he wanted to confirm whether it was human or AI generated responses.
Yeah. Well, I guess before we get onto the broader issue, what happened when he tried to do that? Like, what happened when he asked to speak to them or try to get some sort of response?
Well, at first, the publication really dragged its feet and deflected and didn't respond, but he really pressed the issue. And eventually, not only did the publication deny the allegations, it also solicited further feedback from these anonymous reviewers who remain anonymous, but kind of wrote additional responses to his paper into the accusations. And I actually got to look at those. They're still anonymous, but I read what they told him, and they were offended. I think one of them said, "I am very much a human and not a machine." And those
that's something a robot would say.
I don't know. It had sort of a human flavor to it. Okay. So one thing he did when he suspected that the responses were AI generated, he fed them through a bunch of AI generated text detectors, which we know and he knows as well are flawed. They're not perfect systems. And we've written about this before as it relates to AI image detection. But he fed them to like 7 different detection tools, and all of them detected them as fake. And then he did the same thing to the additional responses after his allegations, and those came back as human. So that sort of added to his, case that they were AI generated, which I should make clear, we don't know if he's right or wrong. Yeah. And there's actually, like, we can get to this later, but there's an explanation for why they would be detected as AI, even if they weren't.
Sure. Before we get to that, again, like, you don't know for sure. Nobody really does, except obviously the reviewers themselves who deny it. But when you read what the reviewers had written, what was just your anecdotal sort of first impression on reading those? Like, did it seem plausible that, hey, maybe these were written with AI? Or
it seems plausible, but not I wouldn't feel comfortable making that determination one way or another. I would say that the additional responses seem very much genuine.
Yes.
I also read this. Like, I read sort of the peer review and the response to it, and I found it to be like really ambiguous, like very difficult to tell, which is part of, I mean, Emmanuel gets into this, but it's like, it's very difficult to tell whether it's, I found the review to be like, I'm not a peer reviewer, but I found it to be really weak in terms of their arguments. Their arguments were like very bizarre to me.
I mean, I've seen a lot of peer reviews. They're not great.
It was just like, I mean, I think he was right to be mad about what the peer review was, because it was like, it was essentially nonsensical in my opinion, but it didn't scream like AI generated necessarily. It was just very odd.
When you guys give me notes on my articles, I'm like, these fucking bots.
Yeah, that's like I was gonna make that joke. I was waiting to make that joke until like the end of the segment. But I mean,
snooze, you lose.
Fair play for getting that in. I appreciate that. But you both bring up this point, which is like, yeah, you read it and like maybe it's AI, maybe it's not. Like, who knows? But like the fact that this researcher who got the feedback, the fact that they even think that it's possible that it could be AI introduces doubt. Right. What's the issue here, Emmanuel?
I think the bigger issue and the thing that people should understand is, I mean, this fear about something being generated by AI or not, at this point, I think everyone is familiar with. It's happening on Facebook. It's happening on porn sites. It's happening in published journals. So it's everywhere. but it is preying on an existing problem in this case, which in the scientific community is broadly called the peer review crisis. And the nature of the crisis is basically that there is far more peer review labor that needs to be done than there is available and willing researchers who can do that labor. And that's been the case for years. And it's been a pretty acute problem for years. And I think people who are academics who are in this space would naturally think that if you're to cut corners, this is like an easy way to do it, right? Which I talked to another researcher from Stanford who like dug into this problem more deeply as it relates to papers that are submitted to conferences, which is not the same thing as papers submitted to journals, but those also require peer review. And they found that there is a sharp rise in AI-generated text in peer reviews for specifically AI conferences.
Meaning that the people who are supposed to be reviewing conference submissions to go, oh, yes, we want this talk or we don't want this talk, they are using AI. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. And an interesting detail there that they were able to map out, because they segmented the papers that they were looking at into 3 days before deadline for the peer review and prior, and there's a sharp spike near to the deadline. So it appears as if, as people are kind of like rushing to meet deadline, there is a higher frequency of AI generated text in the peer reviews.
Very interesting. I guess just my last question is, well, okay, maybe some peer reviewers are using AI. Maybe they're not, and there's just the idea that they could be, and that introduces doubt. But like, what is the potential consequence here? Is it that researchers will just not trust what their peer reviewer is saying? Is it that the quality of academia will go down? Is it that papers won't get submitted? Like, what's sort of some of the potential consequences are of this?
So the most obvious and terrible problem, in my opinion, is that the whole point of peer review is you submit a paper and you get 2 to 3 peer reviews from colleagues. And the whole point of that is to get diversity of opinion and perspective and to try to poke holes in your theory or your paper. And that is kind of what we thought of traditionally as a good part of the scientific process, like a cornerstone of the scientific process. And if all these peer reviewers or an increasing portion of them going forward are going to use, as this researcher in Stanford said, the same ghostwriter, then you're losing that diversity of opinion. You're all these papers and all these peer reviews are just kind of using the same brain, if you will. So that's, I think, the worst problem. But additionally, and we talked about this last week, you know, if you're not deep into science and academia and you're just watching this from the outside, like I am and our readers are, that doesn't look like a good process, and it doesn't look like rigorous science. It looks like rushing and cutting corners, which, I mean, it appears to be.
It's funny that both of these stories, like the Eggsy backdoor and this one, actually have a labor component, which I'm just realizing now, which is that, as you say, there are far too few peer reviewers to deal with the massive workload, and then open source devs are being pushed to burnout to the point where a potentially state agency is taking over the GitHub or whatever.
I saw someone on Twitter say that AI is emerging as like a tool to detect where there is crisis in human labor, which, I mean, feels right to me. This is another example of that.
That's a really, really good way of putting it. Go ahead.
The science, like, journal situation is an absolute nightmare, like, across the board, and not, as Emmanuel said, like, not to do with AI specifically. It's like, this is something that we have written about off and on over the years, but there's like the pay to play aspect of some journals. There's, there's a lot of journals that are spun up as paper mills, where it's just like, submit anything, we'll run it through some sham peer review process and then be able to publish it. There's the preprint phenomenon where it's like scientific papers will get published on Archive, which is ARXIV.com. Especially AI papers will get published there, and they will not be peer reviewed, but they will be a preprint, which means it's like, this is the paper that we're going to submit to peer review. And that version of the paper will go viral. You know, this is not necessarily a bad thing. It's like, sometimes very interesting papers are published there, and sometimes, you know, they're newsworthy, and it's kind of good that they're out there. But the like sort of established scientific process where you do a paper and then scientists review it and try to reproduce it and so on and so forth is, I feel like that's breaking down. And it's really hard to tell how to fix it, especially because, as Emmanuel mentions, it's like a lot of science, especially in the AI space, is being done by AI. So that people are shitting out papers like way faster than humans can actually review them. And then they're getting presented at conferences and so on and so forth. And it's like in some fields, especially, the peer review process is like being ignored entirely.
In terms of what to do, I did talk to like a couple of researchers in the story did suggest ways forward. And when you break it down, inherently, it's a problem of incentives. There's a huge incentive as an academic, as a researcher, as a scientist to publish, right? That's good for your career. It's prestigious. That's how you move forward. It's how you make more money. It's how you get grants. So there's a terrible pressure to publish. But the incentives to review are minimal. You can, whether you do one review a year or three or 10 reviews a year, because it's anonymous, you can't get into details to which papers you reviewed or how many. So if you do one, you can just put it on your resume and be like, I reviewed for this journal or I reviewed for this conference, which is good, but you can just do one. So either you open it up and make it even more transparent and you put everybody's name on it, and that way you can see who's contributing what, or you literally create some sort of credit system where if you're Nature and you want to publish a paper in Nature, then first you have to do three peer reviews or something like this. It's just the incentives are out of whack. We have to fix the incentives.
Yeah, totally. All right, let's leave that there. If you're listening to the free version of the podcast, I'll now play us out. But if you're a subscriber, we're actually going to keep talking about academia in a way. We're going to be talking about a radical change in the image research space. I guess that's one way you could put it. You can subscribe and gain access to that content at 404media.co. As a reminder, 404 Media is journalist-founded and supported by subscribers. If you wish to subscribe to 404 Media and directly support our work, please go to 404media.co. You'll get unlimited access to our articles, an ad-free version of this podcast, and the RSS feed. You'll also get to listen to the subscribers-only section, where we talk about a bonus story each week. Another way to support us is by leaving a 5-star rating and review for the podcast. That stuff really helps us out. And tell a friend about it as well. This has been 404 Media. We'll see you again next week.